Leaders lead. They see a need or an opportunity to make things better, to lead change, and then they take action. Well, we're going to meet one of those change makers in this episode of The Spirit of Leading. I'm Garland McWaters, and my guest on this episode of The Spirit of Leading is Glenn Johnson, the Chancellor of the Oklahoma Regents for Higher Education. Being the Chief Executive Officer of this statewide system of colleges and universities is a gargantuan leadership task. And taking on big leadership roles is a central theme in Chancellor Johnson's leadership story, the story that I'm eager to hear. Chancellor Johnson, thanks so much for taking time in a very busy time of this year to join us on The Spirit of Leading.
Great to be here, Garland. I look forward to this discussion and talking about a topic I think is very important in today's world, and that is the qualities of leadership.
Well, this is leadership is a big thing. Now, of course, when we're recording this, we're right in the throes of all this political stuff going on around us, you know, with the presidential primaries and so forth. So leadership is something really on our minds. And I know in working with young people out in the workplace today that millennials are really, really interested in leadership. They really want to be a part of making things happen and doing things. And so that's why I know they're going to want to hear about your life in leadership, and especially your early days in leadership, because I think they can relate to kind of how you started. You know, you you went to a law school at the University of Oklahoma.
Right.
And I guess you practiced law after that for a while.
I did.
And then something got into your head, and you decided that you wanted to be a legislator. And so when you were, like, 27, 28 years old, you took that on.
Yeah, just turned 28, yes.
You ran for the office, and you won. And so I'm kind of wondering, what led you to that path to want to seek a political office at that time?
Well, I think probably, Garland, a couple of factors went into it. And I guess I should say at the outset, I didn't have any long-term prearranged plan to graduate from law school, go back to Okemah, which was my parents' home and my grandparents' home, and run for office. It really was something that evolved. But as soon as I say that, I grew up in a family where government and elective service was important. My father served in the Oklahoma legislature before World War II, was an officer in World War II, and then right after that war ran for Congress and was elected. So we were in Washington, D.C. in my early days, in my grade school and early high school years. So I was around government. I was around elective office. And certainly that was a factor in terms of just the exposure. Went to finish high school in Muskogee, was involved in student government there, as I was at the University of Oklahoma, and very active in campus activities there, which carried through to law school. I had opportunities in Oklahoma City and Tulsa and other places out of law school, but opted to go back with my father's law firm, although he had been out of it for a number of years, and start my law practice. My first bid for elective office, though, was not the Oklahoma legislature. I was appointed after I'd been back about 9 months to a vacancy on the Okemah School Board, and as it turned out, the position came up for election within about 4 months, and I was elected and served in that for 2 years, mm-hmm. served until I ran for the state legislature. So an interest in education really got me started in my interest in elective office. Quite frankly, in 1982, when I opted to run for the legislature, I had a lot of considerations. I had a law practice that I was establishing, but also had an interest in serving. It was the first run. I didn't know all the ins and outs. My initial base was made up of those that I knew, those that I had frankly represented in my law practice. And then as you get around, you make acquaintances,
right,
and you make alliances and friendships and partnerships. And by the time I was into it for a month, I was more motivated by the fact this was a good thing. I always took that very charge very seriously and responsibly, you know, based on the way my parents brought me up to believe that public service was really a noble calling. And I don't say that to be that there was instilled in me a need that I needed to run for office. It was more, you may never run for office, but it's important you're involved in the process. It's important that you seek out those that you believe in and support them. It's important that you stand up for causes that are important, not so much just seeking elective office.
Right, that's where that sort of comes from. It comes from a sense of a purpose.
Exactly. And that's really what motivated me to get started. We put together a victory that first race, and then from there I started the process that really has determined a lot of things I've done since then.
Right. And Whaley's on the way. Before we go forward, I do want to rewind a little bit, because you mentioned that you had served on the school board, and I certainly want to sort of make an observation here that public service at the community level, city councils, city commissions, school board, incredibly important.
It is.
So many important decisions made at that level, and some people dismiss those as maybe not that important, but they are crucially important to the vibrancy of a community.
Well, they are, and really, in a lot of ways, it's where the rubber meets the road. I mean, you have, when you're talking about, in the case of a school board, but you could say the same thing for city council, you know, those are issues that are bread and butter issues. They're issues, you know, I can recall during the time I was on the school board in Okemah, there'd be issues where we'd have an overflow meeting room, and our meetings sometimes would go several hours because the patrons of that district cared a lot about the way their school was administered and run. And I always tried to take that responsibility, you know, very, very seriously and give it the time that it merited.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in the 1980s, when you were first elected, it was kind of common that youngsters kind of waited their turn, and before they were so bold as to want to run for an office. And I know you mentioned that you ran against an incumbent, and so having gone through that process, and if you can think back to those days, how did that affect you? What did you think about yourself, you know, after having won that election, unseated an incumbent, and now you're on your way to the legislature?
Well, let's get down to it. I had, as I would go into, you know, I'd approach a farmer that was in his 60s or 70s that would look at me and say, okay, now how old are you, son?
Well,
exactly. I'm just turned 28. And you think you're ready to represent this area in the legislature? Tell me what your views are on agriculture in this district. And I, you know, again, it was on me. If I didn't have a response that ultimately convinced this person that, one, I knew what I was talking about, that I understood the needs of the area and I would be able to articulate those needs before those at the Capitol, then I wasn't going to probably get into the door a second time. And as the summer went on, I had more and more individuals tell me. They said, well, you know, quite frankly, I mean, just to be very frank, district is a rural district. And, you know, I had some people say, well, I didn't really like the fact that you were a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But the more that we talk, you know, you're approachable, you get it. You seem to be able to speak from your heart on the things that are important to us here. And it was almost like, I'll give you a pass on the fact that you're an attorney. So, yes, I had, you know, the age issue was raised, but I think more often than not, I think as I would talk to constituents and those that I was not just trying to seek their vote, but really talk to them about my views, they're not going to be able to be at the Capitol every day.
Right.
I think what they want to do is be comfortable that they're going to send someone that understands where they come from, understands what their issues are, you know, not just on the financial issues, but the issues that involve how your community grows and how your community prospers. And as I got through the summer, more and more of them said they felt very comfortable that I got it, that I got where they were coming from, and they'd be comfortable with me speaking for them at the Capitol.
Well, apparently it worked, because they sent you back a few times.
They did.
You back a few times. And as your career progressed, you became, at the tender age of 37, Speaker of the House of Representatives, which at that time Well, you were the youngest speaker, or sitting speaker of the United States at that time. And now you talk about a big job. As big jobs go, not only are you a representative, but now you are, in a sense, administratively responsible for the workings of the House of Representatives and the legislative agenda of the state and all those kinds of things. And what do you think it was that that other legislators looked to you and said, well, I think Representative Johnson could really do a good job in the speaker's role?
Well, I ran for speaker after I'd been in office for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And actually was 36 when I began running for the office. I had the opportunity in those 7 years to either be appointed or elected to some pretty key positions in the House. I think probably because I was a lawyer, the second year of my first term, I was appointed the chair of the Criminal Justice Committee, which was responsible for the corrections issues and all the criminal code and those types of mm-hmm. things. The person that was chairing Judiciary, which is even the bigger committee from a legal standpoint, was then left the legislature. So the beginning of my second term, I was named chair of Judiciary, which is a major committee in the legislature. And I was still 29 years old at that time. Chaired that, and then the next two-year period, there's three elected positions in the House: Speaker, Speaker Pro Tem, and the Caucus Chair. And the Caucus Chair presides over the meeting, in our case, of the Majority Caucus. And I ran for Caucus Chair, and several others did, but I was elected to that. So the members got to see me chairing that conference and speaking on behalf of the conference members. I'd always been on the Budget Committee and went up through the ranks. In 86, I was named the vice chair of the committee. And then in 88, the person that was chair left, and I became the chair of the Budget Committee. You learn lessons along the way. The Budget Committee was great preparation because you literally were responsible. Although the speaker makes the final call, you're the person that basically puts together the budget for the House and negotiates with the Senate and the governor on what the budget is, along with the speaker. And that was great training and great preparation. Midway through my second year, the Speaker of the House was ousted. Acknowledging that we're in a political process, I assume, being one of the key leaders, that meant that my job was gone and I'd go to the back of the room again because the new group would come in and take over those key leadership spots. Turns out the person that was elected speaker when Speaker Barker was ousted, Steve Lewis, was appropriations chair when I was vice chair and had been my seatmate my first term in the legislature. And the first thing he did was call me and he said, given all that, I've got 68 members who want to be the majority leader, which is basically the number two spot in the House. But he said, I want to ask you to take that post. So, I mean, as it turned out, I ended up being in a position as serving as majority leader where you basically conduct the floor activity on a daily basis, to have a lot of interaction with members that I think helped me greatly mm-hmm. when I sought the speaker's office. And as it turns out, within a year, Steve Lewis opted to run for governor, so there was a speaker's race. And I just turned 36. Three members of the House got into it quickly, but I had, again, kind of like for the House seat in my district, a number of members said, we think you ought to get into this. And I said, well, it may already be too late. As it turned out, some were more of the liberal persuasion, some were more of, for lack of a better word, kind of the old guard persuasion. And I seemed to be a middle-of-the-road member that the members had seen me perform. I quite frankly think, to answer your question, a lot of them said they felt comfortable mm-hmm. with the decisions that I would make. They felt comfortable that I would have their back, and that particularly in an era the legislature was getting a good amount of criticism at that time, they felt, again, their words to me, that I would project an image that was kind of image that they would be very comfortable having me in their districts for events and things to represent the and to be the face and the spokesperson for the House. So in 1991, in January, I was elected Speaker. And as you say, time of my election, I was the youngest person in the United States to hold that post.
That's a remarkable story. And again, it goes back, as you were telling that story, the things that kept going through my mind that that made that possible were not only were you performing, which brought some confidence in your skill and your ability and knowledge, but relationships.
Yes.
You had to build relationships in that environment, because you go into the legislature, and I guarantee you, well, you know, that's 101 egos.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's a lot of people with in the legislature who have a sense of wanting to know to put themselves out there and have a stellar political career and so forth. So all those things matter. But being able to work among that group and win that confidence and be able to bring those relationships together is a big
And I think you really nailed it there. The relationship is key. And really the workings are built on those relationships. And also, they want to have trust and confidence. During the years, your word is your bond mm-hmm. in that body, as it should be anywhere. But, you know, when they would talk to me about legislation they were interested in, I'd always try and explain it. Here's the issue. Now, from your district standpoint, you also need to consider these factors. But basically, objectively, this is the issue that will be framed. So. Mm-hmm. I think that does, you know, and you only get to create that impression as a first impression, and sometimes
that's right.
that
once they've the trust is gone, it's just right. almost impossible to get it back. Well, you accomplished the major legislation of those days, and including some of the most significant educational reform for public education at that time. What did you learn? I guess we talked about this a little bit, but what did you learn about working in that kind of a political environment that really helped you be successful trying to bring all these disparate groups or philosophies together to fashion something that really was significant for Oklahoma at
Well,
that
a couple things. I was very gratified. I was elected unanimously by both parties to the position, and that, at least in recent history, hadn't happened before. And that gave me a chance. I immediately embraced several things that I felt needed to happen. I thought our decorum could improve. So we had received a lot of criticism on for all-night sessions of the legislature. I just worked on a House rule to say session stop at midnight. Some things on giving members opportunities to review retirement bills before they voted on them, and just some common sense and issues of that nature. I frankly worked with Steve Lewis, my predecessor, on developing a number of these. Another one was, it sounds simple, but just 24-hour layover on bills from the time they come out of committee until they can be voted on the floor, which gives members a chance to get, if they're not on that committee, get acquainted and acclimated with the issue.
Slowed the railroad down a little bit.
Yeah, and you need to do that on occasion if you're going to make studied decisions. But to go to your the question on, you know, what did I learn just in terms of working in the political environment, I think obviously the legislature is a political body, and there's going to be times when it is partisan. I mean, to say that it's not would be, one, a misstatement, two, completely unrealistic. That being said, though, I always strive to work well with both parties. I met with the minority leader regularly. In those days, I always wanted to make sure that based on what the percentage difference was, in my days it was about 70% majority party, 30% minority party, and to make sure that the minority party had at least 30% representation on all committees. Things like that, mm-hmm. that just, you know, we had a lot of very significant legislation. I don't recall that I had a major piece of legislation during my three terms as Speaker that was a party line vote. And so I think having the other thing that's important, particularly in the role of Speaker, I think the stereotype is that he or she is a, you know, arm twisting, iron fisted, grudge holding individual, and that's how you get things done. I tried to not govern that way, but I always tried to be more, to take more of an approach that to talk to members in terms of how this would be good for their district if they supported it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, by and large, most of the time it would be. And if it was one that was absolutely a negative to the member, I always tried to understand that from their district, and given who they represented, they might not be able to mm-hmm. vote. And then I knew it was on me to get somebody else then to
right.
fill that spot so we could accomplish it, but not do something that might be, you know, terminally detrimental
right.
to that member.
Right.
So I tried to just do that. I think if you have respect for the membership, which I always did, respect for the fact that, you know, in the House's case, 35,000 people had elected them from their district to speak for them, and to not ever discount that, that that was
right.
really important, and that, you know, we've got a great state, but we have a very diverse state, and the interests of someone that comes from southeastern Oklahoma is very, very different mm-hmm. than a member that comes from northwest Oklahoma City.
A lot of millennials are interested in getting involved in politics. What advice would you have to them to that that might help them in their decision to get involved and maybe in the way they approach it?
Well, I have never wavered from the premise that public policy and public office is a very noble calling. I still believe that. I believed it when I was first elected. I believed it the day I left the legislature and the jobs that I've had since then. And so what I think I would say to millennials would be really the advice that I was given a few years ago now. Think about the issues you really care about and weigh in on those, and don't be afraid. You know, my dad told me early in life, he said, don't worry about always following the crowd. He goes, there's going to be some things you care about, and don't be afraid to be the person that takes a different path. Just make sure if you choose to do that, you've studied it, you've analyzed it, you feel like you're doing the right thing, and you're willing to pay the consequences.
Right.
Now, if you do all those things and feel like you're doing the right thing, you're going to be okay. And I would say that's very good advice. And I didn't always follow the crowd. I opted on several occasions to take the road less traveled. But I've never really regretted doing that mm-hmm. in any one of them, because I did give it considerable thought before I did. So I would just say, you know, you could be those that are in the age group of our millennials today could look on the national process and say, you know, this is pretty complicated and it's pretty messy. And, you know, you could make an argument that it is.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, being given that opportunity to vote gives them a chance to exercise, to weigh in, and to be involved, and surely out of the 25 candidates, and I'll just use the presidential race this year, there's somebody that probably should coincide with at least a few of their views. And if they feel strongly about it, weigh in and get involved. If they don't feel that strongly, at least make sure you vote. Because if you don't do that, you're not exercising the option that those in an earlier time in our country really fought for and died for.
That's right. And you know, you get down to those final two choices. Of course, right now we're going through that winnowing process of the presidential election of selecting nominees for the two major parties. And then finally you get down to two, and the choice are among those two and the other marginal candidates that make the ballots. And neither is not on the ballot.
That's right.
Neither is not, you can't vote for neither. You have to vote for one or the other. And so you want to make the choice that fits your beliefs and values most closely.
And if you get involved, you have a chance. If you don't like the way things are going, you have a chance to some degree mold a different outcome.
Well, I know after you finished your work in the legislature, went on to, back to become a professor at the University of Oklahoma at law school, an adjunct, taught public policy, and among other things. And as you engage with young people in those classrooms about public policy, I'm sure you had so many stories to tell about how the value and importance of understanding public policy and the way things get done and the way policy gets made.
Well, it actually, my role at OU was at the law school teaching and also working with President Boren. Here at the Health Sciences Center, they were undergoing a change in structure where University Hospital was joining with Columbia HCA and Presbyterian Hospital to merge mm-hmm. to form a different model. And I was very involved with him with the legislature in bringing that to closure. To me, it was a great time. I love teaching because I got to connect with the students, and it's something I continued as president of Southeastern. I always taught a class right. in the fall on, no surprise, aspects of state government.
Mm-hmm.
But I had the chance to balance that with what I think ultimately we made in 1997 a very appropriate decision to initiate that merger because of the way the healthcare arena was changing. And it's certainly served us well for the last 18 or 19 years.
And when you got to Southeastern, you had a big step up as well to some leadership responsibilities there. That was a time, I believe, that the campus took on a lot of development, and a lot of things happened during that time.
It did. We were it was a great 10 years, quite frankly, not only from the standpoint of I look at our capital program, a campus when we got there in 97 that was founded in 1909. Mm. So most of the buildings, some of them were almost 90 years old. We had some challenges from an infrastructure standpoint. And during that time, we were able to put together through a variety of sources, private funds, federal funds, the bond issue that we pushed through with the legislature in 2005, but we were able to build a new large classroom building to significantly renovate our biological sciences building, new residence halls on campus to because there was additional capacity because of the enrollment increases, but also renovations of the two existing residence halls, which were appropriately named Choctaw and Chickasaw mm-hmm. Tower because of the two Native American tribes in that area, and they were gracious enough to be major donors on right. that project. We also built a new public safety center, and Southeastern served as the state headquarters of the Small Business Development mm-hmm. Center's new building there. We were able to partner with the city in 2004 and put together $16 million in building projects for athletics. We greatly renovated the football stadium. We added new tennis court, a new tennis court complex, a new arena and convocation center, and all of that through a partnership with the city, and it was very significant. The student union on campus had been built in the 30s, and it was small. And the students really, starting in about 2000, wanted to make that one of their initiatives. And they assessed themselves through student fees to do this. We started a major fundraising drive that, as president, I spearheaded. But long and short, in September of 2006, we dedicated the new student union right in the center of campus. Of course, I was very gratified. I came to this position as chancellor in December of 2006. In February of 2010, the Board of Regents, the Regional University System Board of Regents, named the student union in my honor. Oh. So I was not only happy, but very happy that my mother, she was there for that announcement and for that dedication.
That's so really special.
So, a great 10 years, and that's just the building part of it.
Right.
I guess, we expanded academic programs. Our aviation program, which is the most comprehensive in the state, brought it from Southeastern to Tinker Air Force Base, Oklahoma City Community College, Rose State College. We, in the business arena, during my time there, became, in addition to University of Oklahoma, Oklahoma State University, and Tulsa University, the only other public university in the state to have the ACBSP accreditation, mm-hmm. which is the additional level of accreditation for the colleges of business. Right. Very, 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 very pleased to do that. I started programs like the President's Leadership Class, which I interacted with almost on a daily basis. We started President's Partners for private fundraising and would bring in speakers like Barry Switzer and others to speak, Archie Dunham, who was the chair and CEO of ConocoPhillips, and raise money for projects, whether it be something in the residence halls for computers or additional furniture or whatever. We'd have a project each year, band uniforms 1 year. But it, all in all, was a very, it was a busy 10 years. It was very gratifying. I do think we moved the needle there in a significant way, and it was enjoyable from beginning to end for me.
Well, sometimes it's kind of like all the stars just line up. It's the right time for the right kind of action, the right kind of leadership, and things just fall into place. And it is really gratifying to be a part of something like that. Now, I know it hasn't all been blue skies and rainbows in your leadership career and the things that you've had to deal with. I'm sure there have been some soul-searching times as well, times when you've had to stop for a moment and think about, you know, what you were going to do. And yeah, I think you alluded to one or two earlier times that you chose a different path. What was that like, especially being in a visible leadership role, to have to stop and think, well, maybe I need to do something that's going to be a little bit off what everybody's expecting me to do?
Well, I think of a couple. One was the effort back in 1989 and 90 on the major education reform of that time, House Bill 1017. As it started, initially, most of my, coming from a rural district, I had a lot of, most of my schools initially felt like some of the requirements, smaller class sizes, the core curriculum, additional library focus and things like that. Some of the smaller schools were concerned they might not be able to meet all those requirements and it might even jeopardize their viability. And I made a decision early on I was going to support it and be in on the crafting of the bill where I could represent the interests of the smaller schools as we went forward. Initially, it was a pretty, you know, it was a rough patch. I mean, I would go back, and most of those that I'd be talking to were not supportive of what I was doing. And you know, you do soul search, and I felt like basically I'm either going to be able to explain why I'm doing it, and if I don't, I've got to be ready for the consequences. But as it was like a lot of those things, as it evolved and as information became more prominent and as the issue evolved over the period of a year, I think most in my district saw, one, to move our system of K-12 forward, we needed to do this, and two, to do it was going to require some funding, and three, while there might be modifications for the smaller schools, everybody was still going to have to ramp it up. And
right.
And so it ended up, it worked out okay, but there was a point or two there where it might not have.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing I guess I could say, making the decision to run for speaker was it wasn't something I had to do. You know, I'd been there 8 years. Normally you run and lose and your pathway from there is not always rosy. So I had to weigh that. You know, if I kind of lay back and support somebody, I'll probably be, you know, in pretty good shape versus jumping in there and realizing if you choose to do this and don't prevail, you may end up, you know, at the back of the line. No regrets on any of those, but I did, you know, you do have to some degree look at your options and make sure you're committed to doing it. And then my experience has always been, once I do that, I don't look back. You just move ahead and do all you can. You know, you don't have to be the best every time. If you're giving it 100% and you try to do your best, you're going to come out okay.
And being true to yourself, I think, speaks a lot. And, of course, one of the words that a lot of people use today in leadership is authenticity.
Yes.
We don't always agree, but, you know, we know who you are, and we're okay with that.
Well, you know, you say that. It's interesting. I know I would get into a discussion sometimes with constituents. There'd be a bill, and no surprise, I'd be home on Friday to form, and I'd have somebody say, well, I don't agree with your vote on House Bill 1010. And I'd say, okay, well, here's why I voted the way I did. And I'd go through it. And mm-hmm. and more than a few times, they would say, I still don't agree with the vote you made, but I respect the fact that you believe you voted the right way and you evaluated it, you know, before you cast your vote.
Right.
Which tells me that I think voters are sophisticated enough. I think they understand they're not going to have anybody that coincides with their views 100%.
Right.
And as I would say, you know, I bet 90 2 or 3% of the time we click. I mean, there's going to be times we don't agree, but I bet on most of these issues we do. And I think voters are sophisticated enough to know there's not going to be anybody that you're completely aligned with on every issue every single time.
Right.
And they understand. But I do think, to go to the authenticity issue that you mentioned, they may not agree, but they want you to at least be able to show them that you analyze it before you made your decision.
Right. And that you respected their position as well.
Absolutely.
And so that, you know, you may disagree, but I can respect that your decision is a different, or your position is a different than mine, but that's okay. It doesn't keep us from moving forward on other things as well. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't address the issue of Oklahoma's funding situation now. And I know today, as we're recording this podcast, you've been in budget development, I guess, or negotiations or whatever, for the higher education system. And I'm sure that this, you've really had to draw on a lot of leadership resources, your own skill, and you know, your own relationships. What's that been like? How have you worked through this, or how are you working through this to really try and get to the best possible solution?
Well, it's my responsibility as chancellor to be the spokesperson for the system. Under the way we're structured, we make the request on behalf of all the institutions. But today's a good example of our. We had well over two-thirds of our presidents of the Capitol with me today, going not only to the budget chairs and the pro tem and speaker, and we met with all of them, and they were very gracious. I mean, if you imagine, here with 4 weeks to go, with literally hundreds of issues on the table, they all took time to meet with us today, mm-hmm. and to stay with us until we not only had a meaningful discussion, but everybody's questions were fully answered. So, I mean, I think that speaks well for those that are there right now. But as far as what I've had to draw on to do this, I think part of it is, you know, this we're looking at a significant budget crisis. So we've got to look at what we put on the table. You know, where else in government, you look at what we've done, this degree completion initiative called Complete College America, even with this budget situation we've been in, the first 3 years in the program, we have met our additional degree requirements each and every year. I think rightfully we're sounding the alarm to the governor and legislature that we don't know if we're going to be able to do this for 12 years if our budgets are reduced or even flat. And again, if you look at how important that is, what do more graduates mean? The Georgetown study that came out earlier told us that not in 10 years or even 5 years, in 3.5 years, 67% of the jobs in this state are going to require some college, long-term post-secondary certificate, or an associate's degree, and 37% of those jobs are going to require an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, or higher. That's on our back right now to do that. And the only way we can deliver by offering the programs for our graduates to graduate on time and to fill these job needs that are out there and are going to be out there is to give us the resources to do our job. And, I mean, basically, that's our pitch. Our pitch is, you know, if there's going to be a cut, we hope it's a minimum cut, but protect higher education so we can do our job. And it's really not about us. It's not about me. It's not about the presidents or the regents. It's really about the students. It's about giving them, through what we do, the resources to be successful, mm-hmm. giving them the resources to stay in this state and have a job in this state, to get out of this downturn that we're in. The economy is the way we do that, strengthen the economy. Nobody can do that quicker, better, more comprehensively than we can in higher education. So that's the case we're making. It's the right case. I mean, it's important work. It's work that opens doors and builds careers for students and changes their life. We're committed to it. We do believe we're on the right side. But again, we've got to make the case with all of the issues that are out there and with a significant shortfall that this issue is important and that mm-hmm. it's important enough that it merits their consideration to do what they can to protect higher education, to give us a flat budget, or if there is a cut, that it be a minimum cut so we can produce the graduates to fill these job needs and do our job.
Yeah. Well, like I said earlier, it's a gargantuan job, but hey, what's new? And I certainly commend you and all those who are working so hard on all the policy matters across the board. They put the blood, sweat, and tears into that process. And if I know people don't get to see that every day. They don't see the real hard work that goes on in the legislature, and not just when you're in session, but all the time, you know, when you're not out of session as well. One final question. What would you say is your real philosophy of leading, the philosophy of leading that you look back on and say, well, I've tried to live by this? And as also as a matter of way of what you might be, the advice that you might be offering to young leaders today who are starting to step out, you know, take their first steps into leadership.
There's a lot of definitions of leadership. I kind of always look on it as providing the reason and the momentum to steer a group or to steer individuals to a certain course of action. And to do that, you've got to be persuasive. You have to be an articulate communicator. You have to set a good example. You can't tell them, let's all meet at 7 o'clock in the morning and do this, and then show up at 8. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to reinforce in them that you're successful as a team, and that the team is where the strength comes from. Every person involved in the effort has a different role, but that this isn't about any one individual. It's about the team accomplishing a goal that is important to everyone in that mm-hmm. team. It's said a lot, but it's really true. If you approach an issue and you're not worried about getting the credit, you're going to be able to accomplish a lot more mm-hmm. than if it's structured where the credit falls your way. And I think it's really important to be able to do that. You got to be able to seize the moment. If you see that there is a vacuum there, you got to be willing to step into the fray and sometimes take some chin hits. But again, if it's important enough, you're willing to do that. And so I think today, we're seeing leadership at the Capitol right now. They are confronted with a shortfall, but they are working, I think, very hard to try and come up with solutions to this budget dilemma that will move our state forward. And I mean, that's really in the final analysis, that's what it's all about. If you are a leader, you know, you can always say, if you just strive and give it 110% to do your best, it's going to come out. It'll come out fine in the end.
Well, that's a big job, and it's been a delight to listen to you talk about your career in leadership and your life in leadership. And I know there's a lot of great lessons that we can all can learn from that, from the example that you've set for us, and the encouragement that it's never too young to start.
No, that's right.
If you feel like that's your calling and you're just still wet behind the ears, go for it.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, regardless of whether it's a successful the first time out or not, you started and you offered yourself and you got in there, and who knows what might happen. So I want to encourage all of those young people who are thinking about life and leadership and public service particularly to do that. So I want to congratulate you on your lifetime of service to the state of Oklahoma, and thanks so much for joining us on this Spirit of Leading podcast.
My pleasure to do so, Carl. Thank you.
Glenn Johnson, the Chancellor of the Oklahoma State Regents for Higher Education, our guest on this episode of The Spirit of Leading. I want to encourage you to move forward in the spirit of leading in your own life, in whatever walk of life that you are in. Be watching for our next installment of The Spirit of Leading. You can listen and subscribe on iTunes Podcast or on Stitcher. You also can sign up on my blog site, www.empoweredtolead.com. So until then, I urge you to encourage the spirit, to enliven the heart, to enlighten the mind, and to enlarge the expectations of living in yourself and in others. In the spirit of leading, I urge you to live each and every day empowered. I'm Garland McWaters.